Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, modern economics isn't just a dismal science, it's heartless and cold, or can be a lot of the time. So many people struggle desperately to survive, and the planet is a hot mess thanks to human greed and competition. So why do we presume the study of economics is fundamentally, necessarily amoral? Is ethical capitalism even possible? Today, we explore these questions with author and academic Nick Romeo, whose new book, The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy, challenges what we accept as just the way it is. That's next after this news. This is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. Why does it seem we collectively accept or at least resign ourselves to a soul-crushing economic system that makes almost everybody's welfare secondary to that of a few richy riches? Like the proverbial fish in a fishbowl, it's hard to see the water you swim in while you're swimming in it. Nick Romeo's new book, The Alternative, offers a short list of ways people in a number of developed economies are challenging red-in-tooth-and-claw capitalism. And he joins us here in studio to ask if they point a way for us all to demand a more just economy. Nick, a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So a lot of people like me know you primarily from your writing for the New Yorker magazine. And I recall a few years ago a headline, it's time for a new economics curriculum. Is that what this is, The Alternative, an economics book for the young ones coming up?
Absolutely. And in fact, that article from The New Yorker about really the fight for the heart and soul of the Econ 101 class in universities, that was expanded to be the first chapter of the book. So that chapter really looks at how people are taught to think about economics and the ways that an economics education can either constrain or hopefully expand our sense of what's possible in the economy.
Economics was, I think, first called the dismal science by the Scottish philosopher Thomas Carlyle in 1849. And my guess is you'd agree with that assessment, dismal.
I'm so glad you brought up that quote. I would actually say it's neither dismal nor a science. It's, I think, properly understood as a branch of political philosophy. And I'm in good company in that opinion. John Maynard Keynes had a similar view. And it doesn't have to be dismal either. I mean, it's a pretty rich and interesting discipline, and if you push hard on economic questions, pretty quickly you get to really deep philosophical ones. What is happiness? What is a fair society? What's a good way to value the natural world, future generations, etc.? These are not scientific questions. They're philosophical and political ones.
You know, also I'm thinking of some news that we have breaking today. The California minimum wage for 500,000 fast food workers rising to $20 an hour. But it's a complicated story that I think reflects a lot of the principles you consider in your book. Small employers are cutting worker hours to compensate and cutting some workers altogether. It would seem like California, and I suppose the rest of the nation, is kind of addicted to cheap labor.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I do have an entire chapter on the book that explores the history of the notion of a living wage, which even with this recent increase, I think California would fall short of most reasonable definitions of a living wage. People would still not be able to do things like save enough to retire comfortably.
Own a home,
childcare, a rainy day fund, your car breaks down. All of the normal things that happen in life, you know, there's a reasonable argument to be made that a wage should support that. Now, wages are something that exists in a context, right? So the strength of the surrounding social safety net does make a difference to these conversations. And I think to put pressure on wages alone without a rich supporting social safety net, I think there's a case that that's a little unreasonable.
You know, during the pandemic, a number of governments, state, federal, international, started doing more for individual people than they had in a very long time. And I think that prompted a lot of economists, I'm thinking of Wendy Carlin at University College London, to ask if, oh my goodness, morality was making a comeback, economically speaking. But a couple years on, and it doesn't look like it, does it?
Well, you know, I guess I do have some hope. I'm an admirer of Wendy's work. In fact, Wendy and one of her colleagues, Sam Bowles, who is an American economist, they are two of the economists spearheading this effort to reform economics education. Part of what that means is just changing the actual content of textbooks. Part of it is making the textbooks freely available. And then, you know, part of it is also shaping how the public thinks about economics. It was actually the American economist Paul Samuelson famously remarked, "I don't really care who writes a nation's laws if I can write its economics textbooks." So it's a little bit of a creepy or sinister quote. You know, he realizes his power as a shaper of cultural common sense. So who writes these textbooks? What's in them? These are really important questions. And I think, you know, it's understandable to feel like we've backslid since the pandemic, like maybe some momentum was starting to build there and now that's gone away. Then again, you know, I think it's hard to say what the long-term consequences of that will be. I think that story is not finished.
You know, reading this book, I kept thinking of that famous Mark Twain quote, there are three kinds of lies, damned lies, and statistics. And I'm wondering if you could share with us how you think economists use mathematics to make some pretty, I want to say, amoral cases, that mass inequality is unavoidable but necessary if you want economic growth, or that people are fundamentally selfish. And that, you know, the most effective descriptions of what's going on economically start with that principle.
That's a really fascinating question. You know, one very senior economist, when I was researching this book, he said something to me off the record, and you'll understand why it was off the record when I share it. He was reflecting on the use of mathematics in the economics profession today, and he called it mathematics is basically functioning as masturbation in the monastery. So what he meant by that, you know, I think it's fairly clear, but it's sort of only pleasing to the people doing it, and it tends to be incredibly inward-looking and cloistered and have very little connection to a broader empirical reality. One other anecdote that comes to mind from some of the reporting was an undergraduate student at University College London. They were having a discussion with a teaching assistant about income inequality, and they asked a question about something called the Gini coefficient, which just measures how much income inequality is present in a society. They said, what do the data tell us is the ideal Gini coefficient? I think this shows a really deep and common misunderstanding that somehow if we just have enough numbers, enough math, we'll be able to answer moral questions, right? And so the teaching assistant, to their credit, they said, look, this is not a question the data will ever answer. We have to sort of have a conversation about what's an appropriate level of income inequality. We can't just crunch enough numbers to answer that question. I think broadly, you know, mathematics can function as a kind of smokescreen or camouflage to conceal these really rich, important moral and political debates. I mean, we could go on for the whole hour about this, and I'm happy to, but I do think math is an important tool, but a limited one. And a lot of very smart economists seem to share that view based on my reporting.
So how do economists who want to, you know, take a more righteous approach, how do they measure doing well or doing good, you know, when there's not really much agreement, especially among the powerful and the wealthy?
So, yeah, I mean, doing well, doing good, you know, a standard economic metric is, of course, GDP. Growth has an almost sacred religious status among a lot of economists. You know, people, including many economists who are more skeptical of the standard arsenal of economic statistics, they're not advocating that we get rid of all math or we get rid of all statistics. They're simply saying, you know, growth for whom, right? Like GDP is a pretty blunt instrument. Like what if we actually looked at the distribution of GDP across an entire economy? And what if we had a sense of which parts or sectors of the economy were benefiting. You could do the same thing on a global scale. You know, of course, there are these other initiatives where they try to measure sort of national happiness, create some kind of index or, you know, composite measurement with a lot of indicators for how well people feel they're doing subjectively. So, you know, I don't actually get too far into these debates in the book, but there are a lot of smart economists and smart people from outside of economics who are kind of increasingly recognizing these tools are very blunt instruments and they don't actually reveal a lot of the things that we care most about. You know, what are the impacts of economic growth on the natural world? Who benefits most from this growth? And does the growth even make us happy?
You know, I think even before capitalism, as we've come to understand it, was in place, employers, you know, going back to ancient times again, have preferred their employees cheap and easily replaceable. Is it not? Can one not argue this is just the way of things? I mean, like, what, and is it the job of economists to suggest that it shouldn't be?
That's a really rich question. You know, I think if you look closely at the last few hundred years of history, which, you know, a lot of the economic historians who I cite in the book, they've spent decades doing this. It's striking how much things have changed. You know, what's considered normal and natural today was not very recently. I'm thinking of things like protections for workers in a workplace, whether or not children work, whether or not people who are injured at work have any kind of recourse, whether or not you can be sexually assaulted at work. All of these things, you know, that we might just take for granted today, they were actually the results of debate, struggle. They were not somehow just inevitable features of markets. So the way a market is set up always reflects its kind of historical and political time. And there's no reason to think that will stop, that we're at the end of history and that somehow we figured it all out. I mean, a lot of the things that we take for granted today, like the way our economic transactions impact non-human species, future generations, the natural world, this could easily look very different a few centuries from now. It could just be a very strange kind of artifact of our present moment. So I think that kind of long historical perspective is useful for denaturalizing economics and realizing just how strange it is, some of the things we take for granted today.
That's a really good way of putting it. You know, you have to presume historians will look back and laugh at us forever thinking that certain things were obvious. We are discussing whether a just economy is possible, dear listeners. How should we measure success? And is it time to re-examine how we study it? A new book called The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy, offers a short list of ways people in a number of developed economies are challenging the givens. And we're talking with its author, Nick Romeo, writer for The New Yorker, lecturer at UC Berkeley. How were you taught economics? Do you think our current methods for assessing economics are sufficient, or do you feel when you hear statistics about the economy that they are untrustworthy? So many questions. Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Rachel Miro. You're listening to Forum. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim, and I am talking today with Nick Romeo, writer for The New Yorker, lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and author of the new book, The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. Dear listeners, feel free to join the conversation now that you have your phone at the ready, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Of course, you can email us at forum@kqed.org or find us on all the social media channels. We're at KQED Forum. So get those comments and questions coming in. We have quite a few of them, but I wanted to talk about some of the examples you do offer in this book because they are so interesting and they raise so many questions. And you make you wonder, like, what are the other ways we could be doing capitalism, as it were? I'm thinking of purpose trusts, venture capital funds addressing wealth inequality and climate change, worker-owned cooperatives. But I guess I would love to kick off with Marienthal, and basically it's a discussion of the norms we came to accept with clothing, just the manufacture of clothing, and how this particular example shows a different way to do that industry, as it were.
Oh, yeah. So Marienthal is actually a job guarantee program just outside Vienna, Austria. So they do make a little bit of clothing, but mostly the point of the trial, which is still ongoing, is to say what happens when anyone who has been unemployed and would like to work is guaranteed a job. So just like the name suggests, it's a guarantee. You have a long-term unemployed population, none of whom are forced to take a job, but all of whom are offered one if they want it. And it's also kind of important to note that they co-design the work. So they'll sit down with a social worker and try to figure out what are some things the community needs and what are some things I want to do and I'm good at, and how can we match those two sets to create a really meaningful work experience. And the results so far have been really striking. Some of the economists and social workers studying the program in Marienthal, which I should say is just outside Vienna, Austria, it's a small town, they find, you know, that work is much more than a source of income. This is probably not a surprise to anyone, but what is surprising is just how deeply its absence can be implicated in depression, addiction, all kinds of physical and psychological ailments. So once people join a job guarantee, they tend to do a lot better. They report increased self-esteem, increased levels of social connection to their surroundings. So it's a kind of interesting experiment that shows, I think, that a job is much more than just a source of income.
You know, it makes me think of so many different areas in the United States where there was an industry with a long history of extracting profit from, you know, what might be a local manufacturing hub or mining hub or forestry hub. And then the industry moves on. They find cheaper labor or more plentiful resources elsewhere, and they just leave that community with nothing. Does a job guarantee program really help with that, or just soften the edge?
One of the things that's fascinating about the Austria trial is that the cost of the job guarantee is actually slightly lower than what the Austrian government would be spending on unemployment anyway. So they have a relatively generous social safety net. If you would spend no more on something and people subjectively are doing better and the community objectively is having more of its needs met, it feels like a kind of obvious win-win. You know, does this actually decrease long-term trends? Deindustrialization is a problem in a lot of the developed world. People worry about AI these days. It's a little bit hard to say, I guess, in a particular case, whether that just softens the edge or actually solves the problem. But I think it's an interesting intervention that kind of expands our political imagination, where a job can be conceived of as part of a social safety net. You're guaranteed a job in the same way that you might have a public option for housing, healthcare, childcare. What if you also had a public option for the work that you do? One thing that would be very likely is that you'd see upward pressure on wages. Private sector employers would have to compete, right? You would see private sector employers, especially ones that don't treat workers particularly well or pay them well, you know, workers would know they had an attractive public sector option. And for proponents of a job guarantee, that's the point.
Chris writes, "It always amazes me how modern economists espouse economic growth as being essential, but they have no plan on how we will survive the repercussions." But it sounds from what you're saying is like that's true for quite a few modern economists, but not all of them.
Absolutely. I mean, there are many people who are skeptical of growth. And I mean, often the way the debate is even framed is a little bit too binary. It's not necessarily a question of growth or non-growth, but it's growth for who, right? I mean, do we need more schools and hospitals in parts of Africa? And will that take fossil fuels? Absolutely, yes. Do we need more super yachts floating around the Mediterranean owned by Silicon Valley folks? No, right? So, I mean, it's not growth versus non-growth, I think. And I think a lot of economists are developing more nuanced ways of thinking about the topic. And even the word degrowth, you know, many people have realized that rhetorically, it's a bit of a disaster. As soon as you say degrowth, it shuts down a conversation precisely because it has this either-or framing.
Is part of the problem, you think, that, you know, we often, I guess we generally, and economists specifically, often discuss the economies of specific countries with these, you know, as if their borders were hard and fast instead of porous because we're all interconnected?
That's a really important point. Yeah, there's a kind of, I don't want to say fraudulent, but certainly misleading accounting that's happening around national borders and emissions processes. So if you're trying to account for emissions, you know, the scope really matters. And I think the climate crisis is an important wake-up call for expanding that scope to the globe, right, which we all inhabit. I mean, one of the things I get into in the book that's trying to do this in a very tangible way is true price accounting, which traces along an entire supply chain all of the relevant externalities for a product. That could be a smartphone, it could be a chocolate bar. But how can we actually account for the price of something along the entire supply chain?
Another interesting model that you highlight is Mondragon in the Basque region of Spain. Tell us about what you think is special about Mondragon and what you think we can learn from it.
Yeah, Mondragon's an amazing region of Spain, and it's also the name of a federated network of worker-owned cooperatives, largest in the world. They have about 80,000 workers. Two things are really salient when you think about Mondragon. One is that they have a cap on the ratio of the highest to the lowest paid workers, and that cap is 6-to-1. So by American standards, this is wild, right? I mean, compare 350-to-1. Yeah,
yeah,
350-to-6-to-1. It's just, it's a whole different world. Another really important thing to notice about Mondragon is the democratic governance model, where workers get to vote on important decisions. So if you imagine an American company being structured along those lines, it would function very differently. And yet, Mondragon is highly successful. They have all kinds of different businesses, everything from industrial manufacturing of things like jet engines to grocery stores and consulting firms.
Although, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of like the story of auto manufacturing in Germany and how even though you had workers on the board, or perhaps, I don't know, not because you had, but even though you had workers on the boards of many of those companies, they didn't help the country shift direction with manufacturing until some would argue it was just far too late. You know, they kind of they're behind the times as far as, you know, zero or lower emission vehicles. You know, they've kind of lost out on the Chinese market, you know. And you would think that having the intelligence of folks working the line would make a difference. But there is a huge example of how it didn't.
That's certainly relevant. And I think, you know, having worker involvement in key decisions about how a company functions is not a guarantee of success. Then again, neither is the exclusion of workers, right? And if you sort of have a commitment to democracy in the political sphere, there's not, I think, a good argument for abandoning it in the economic sphere. And Mondragon is a kind of powerful case study of how, you know, for many, many decades now across many, many sectors, you have a really successful firm competing internationally in markets around the world, and also incorporating worker voice and keeping pay inequality to really quite small levels compared to most other firms in the world.
Catherine asks, if we have a minimum wage, why don't we have a maximum wage? Yeah.
That's a great point. I mean, I think it's an important thing to consider. You know, Mondragon, within its own sort of sphere of operations, effectively does do that. Whether national legislation could do something similar, I think, is absolutely worth considering. One other sort of American example that I talk about in the book involves businesses that are owned by legal trusts. Some of those trusts stipulate a maximum pay ratio. So a retiring founder will say, I'm going to turn over ownership to this trust. Now, the trust owns my business, and whoever works for this business in the future, they will never make, you know, more than 10 times what the lowest paid worker does.
Corey writes, employee ownership is now quite common in the U.S. The National Center for Employee Ownership, I imagine Corey is actually quite educated on this topic, just found that the number of workers in employee-owned companies jumped by 423,000 people the most recent year. Given the new successes of this idea in the U.S., why are you one of the few writers talking about it?
You know, I think employee ownership is a very, very powerful strategy for reducing wealth inequality. It shows up in many chapters in the book, and I think Corey's absolutely right that more people should be talking about it. You know, as for why they're not, I am hopeful that that's changing. I probably shouldn't go too far into a full-scale critique of the way the mainstream media covers economics, but there's a lot to be critical of, you know. I think sometimes the strategies that are actually effectively working are somewhat marginalized, which is unfortunate.
Doug writes, I've long felt that the GDP figure isn't a realistic number when part of the number includes debt of trillions of dollars sometimes. I do not understand how such a huge negative number can be ignored. Another economic figure we need is the value to an economic future a job provides.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many angles from which one can critique GDP. There's the exclusion of household and domestic labor. There's the exclusion of truly enormous externalities and costs that our economic system imposes on the environment. So I'm completely sympathetic to critiques of GDP. And, you know, a lot of economists are as well. This might be another point at which we could wonder why the mainstream media sort of so constantly invokes this figure and fixates on it in a lot of reporting.
This takes me back to my days working at Marketplace in Los Angeles. And, you know, Marketplace and, for that matter, NPR often use as a what's called an accordion, just as you're about to hit a post and you don't know if you're going to need 3 seconds or 7 seconds before you hit that post. They'll use the market indices, you know, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose by 62 points. And, you know, even within the newsroom, we would talk about how this really wasn't a particularly good number or statistic to share widely with such regularity, because it gave a false impression of its importance, didn't really tell you much about what's actually happening. But it was sort of helpful just given the structure of radio broadcasts.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I agree that is maybe a practice that the media should consider phasing out. I mean, there's so many more important things to talk about, even within an economic sphere. So, yeah, that's a fascinating observation.
A listener writes, assuming that capitalism tends to make corporations and individuals focus on the bottom line, profits, self-survival, how does our society survive such selfishness? Most recent examples of the harm capitalism has caused include Boeing and Wells Fargo.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of my goals in the book was to showcase a series of specific kind of hopeful case studies, some of which do involve the private sector, right? It's not necessarily a kind of legitimate inference to say, well, just because some companies are misbehaving, all of them are never to be trusted, and we need to kind of socialize and nationalize every major industry. That's in no way my argument. What I do argue is that markets are institutions. They always reflect previous political and philosophical commitments. And if we design them intelligently, there are much, much more effective ways to minimize some of those very severe harms. I mean, in a case like Boeing, the regulatory apparatus is crucial. But, you know, in a lot of other cases like executive compensation, some of the models I discuss in the book, places like Mondragon, structures like purpose trusts, these are pretty powerful mechanisms. Employee ownership, of course, is another that we've touched on. These can start to rein in the sort of free fall of economic equality, or the explosion of inequality would be a better way to put it. Yeah.
Along those lines, another listener writes, it's obscene that people like Bezos and Zuckerberg have billions of dollars, yet we also have millions of people living on the streets without shelter, food, healthcare, or basic necessities. Shouldn't economic systems guarantee the very basic necessities of life for the most vulnerable people in society?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's another area in which the idea of a guarantee, what should be guaranteed, right? What is a sort of appropriately reconceived social safety net for this century, given some of those conditions that the questioner alludes to? A job seems like a very plausible candidate. Housing, childcare, healthcare, I mean, all of these things. I think once you move away from the myth that markets are always the most efficient mechanisms to allocate resources in a society, all of this is on the table.
Dear listeners, jump in on this conversation. We've got a lot of commenters, not so many phone calls. So now would be the time to pick up that phone and call 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. That said, we do have Peter on the line from San Francisco. Hi, Peter. Thank you for joining us today. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you. What I was curious about is the larger impacts of a variety of economic results. So, for example, it's true that we're talking about wages and fair wages and maybe even maximum wages or income. But what about the impact on entirely social sort of social institutions and legislation? So, for example, the impact of people with huge money influence legislation, regulations, for example, you know, did the tobacco industry have undue influence on health regulations and that sort of thing? Those are much less obvious sorts of impacts on our whole society than, you know, just talking about wages or fairness, that sort of direct impact on the players directly involved.
Peter, it's a very great question, and we're about to go into a break. So I'm going to ask Nick to hold off until after the break to answer that question. Don't go anywhere. We are talking with Nick Romeo, writer for The New Yorker, lecturer at UC Berkeley, and also the author of The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy, new book just out. Join our conversation at 866-733-6786. Email your questions to forum@kqed or find us on social media at KQED Forum. Whatever you do, stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim, and I am talking today in studio with Nick Romeo, who is the author of a new book, The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. We've been getting some awesome, super educated, super provocative comments and questions on the phone from people like Peter in San Francisco. Nick, you want to take it away with the answer?
No, I mean, it's a great question, Peter. Thank you. And I absolutely share the concern about regulatory capture, about enormous lobbying efforts by very well-funded corporations. I think these are all important obstacles to overcome. You know, I mean, a few specifics come to mind. One of the things I talk about in the book is kind of changing the default model of a corporation from something that tries to profit maximize at all costs to something with a broader purpose or function. So a purpose trust is one way to do this, where retiring owners or younger business owners turn ownership over to a legal instrument, which then can say the purpose of the business is now supporting worker ownership, hiring formerly incarcerated people, donating a stipulated percentage annually to an environmental nonprofit. So a famous recent example of a purpose trust conversion is Patagonia. But there are many, many smaller businesses around the country doing it. And I think, you know, if the sort of default assumption was that a corporation doesn't try to do that, you know, that would go a long way toward advancing some of these other goals and also maybe towards diminishing the power of some of those same lobbyists.
What do you say to small, especially small employers or medium-sized employers who might say, look, Nick, I care about my workers. I care about being an ethical business person. But you're asking me to, you know, take a knife to a gunfight. You know, like I'm fighting in a bigger soup of companies that are not bringing these values to bear in the way they operate.
That's a great question. And, you know, I think two thoughts come right to mind. One of the people I talk about in the chapter on living wages is a millennial in Washington, D.C. named Aaron Sayedian. He founded a business called Well-Paid Maids, where the basic point of the business is to pay cleaners well. He actually wanted to start the business as an intervention into D.C. debates about wage setting. His whole goal was to show, I can succeed while paying people well. So I guess within your metaphor, if you're good with a knife at the gunfight, things might be fine. To take it a little more seriously, sure, like free riders are a problem. And if you're behaving ethically, but no one else within your sector is, you're at a disadvantage. The way the free riding problem is solved in game theory typically is through regulation, right? So that is, I think, the ultimate solution here. It's not just to rely on the ethical values of a few business owners who are willing to, say, make less money to pay their workers well. It's to set universal binding floors and perhaps ceilings.
Very well put. Well, why don't we take another call? How about Starchild in San Francisco? Hi, Starchild.
Good morning. Hi. I wanted to, push back a little bit on the idea that fairness and justice requires government regulation, because anytime you pass a law, it's ultimately based on the threat of violence. And, you know, it's baked into the system in ways that people don't usually think about. But, you know, I believe each of us has the right to live as we choose so long as we don't initiate force or fraud against others. This is called the non-aggression principle. It's basically the idea of a consent-based society. You know, one business might be providing more justice in terms of paying a higher wage, but another one might be providing, you know, more justice in terms of offering lower prices and keeping people's cost of living low for people that have trouble affording stuff.
Interesting ideas. Any thoughts, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big topic to raise. And I think it sort of gets into theories of the state, theories of human nature. I guess, you know, my view is that we probably do want and need government regulation for all sorts of issues, whether that's product safety, like Rachel mentioned, Boeing aircraft, whether that's regulation of child labor, workplace safety, but also some of the other issues we've been discussing, like guaranteeing basic wages, perhaps also guaranteeing work. I think all of these things are not necessarily best left to private markets. We have a lot of experience now trying that, and it hasn't worked out particularly well. It's not to say that the government has a perfect track record. I mean, a lot of what I do in the book is sort of argue for a third way that threads in between public and private options in a lot of kind of subtle, intricate ways. So, I mean, I think the public-private debate is often how these questions get framed. My own view is that there's a important role for both.
Joe brings us back to the international conversation, writing, capital, like water, flows to the lowest spot, i.e. lowest cost and highest returns, especially in a global economy. Short of implementing a global alternative economy, what prevents that from happening?
That's a fascinating point. I mean, that is why a lot of economists are pushing for a global wealth tax and for global corporate tax regulation schemes. I mean, that, I think, is the ultimate end game. So those are important goals. I don't go too far into them in the book, but absolutely. I mean, we do need that kind of global perspective. Otherwise, tax evasion, people will offshore their money very effectively, as we've seen in the last few decades. You know, more specifically, like to take the Mondragon example, some people have criticized Mondragon because they do rely on precursors that come from very low-wage countries. They have made some efforts to cooperativize workers in places like China and Mexico, you know, those legal environments can be very different and very challenging to do that. And so it is difficult in a globalized economy to kind of ensure ethical behavior and conditions along these huge supply chains.
You know, along those lines, you know, a listener notes that a lot of your examples are European in nature and says socialism gets a very bad name among Americans. This is not the case in some Scandinavian countries. Why is that?
That's an interesting point. I mean, absolutely. The language itself has become so polarized and incendiary in America that many people sort of instantly have this mental model where as soon as you propose some level of government intervention or regulation, then images flash into their mind from like the bleakest years of the Soviet Union, and they think that's what you're proposing. So why is that not the case in Northern Europe? I think because they have a very sort of effective economy that mixes some of the best features of public and private along the lines that I argue for in the book.
A listener writes, Americans have been so brainwashed to believe capitalism is the only way, and anything else is at best liberal meddling and at worst communism. The nuance and complexity of any idea outside of our current system seems impossible for most Americans to understand and digest. It's sad since we could do so much better, but I don't believe we ever will.
Well, you know, I share the not the pessimism, but I share the sort of the sense that there is some level of brainwashing happening. I guess the reason I don't share the pessimism has to do with the chapter in the book that focuses on education. I mean, there are a lot of smart people both within and beyond economics who are really trying to change the way the subject is taught. And I think thinking about universities and think tanks and the media as this kind of crucial choke point where if we can alter that one node, we can really expand our political imagination. I think that does give me some level of hope.
To sort of expand the conversation.
Absolutely.
John writes, is it good or bad that different countries have different economies and cost of living and wages vary worldwide? Should we have one world economy and one currency? Would that be better or worse?
That's a really interesting question. I think we would need an entire forum episode to really tackle the whether we should have one currency question. I mean, there's a lot of interesting research on that. I don't think that's – it's a little bit hard to discuss that without sort of sounding utopian, and I'm not even sure it would be desirable. You know, in the last few years, the sort of move to – what some people call industrial policy, and what they mean by that is basically moving more manufacturing back onshore. Obviously, things like the CHIPS Act and some of the major Biden legislative achievements. But, you know, this is a conversation around the world where the fragility of six continent supply chains was clearly exposed during the pandemic. And so whether you approach this from a national security standpoint, as some people on the right might, or from a kind of worker empowerment standpoint, as people on the left might, I think there are strong arguments against having a hyper-globalized economy.
A listener writes, I struggled with economics in school because Econ 101 demanded so many behavior assumptions that are unrealistic. And it sounds from our conversation like that could be true whether an economist is left-leaning or right-leaning, that they both have unrealistic assumptions about human behavior.
That's absolutely true. I mean, that's one of the things that the economists behind the efforts to reform the education sort of sector of economics, they are very intent on having a richer, more nuanced psychological portrait of humans. Partly that comes out of game theory and behavioral economics. Partly it comes out of the humanities. I mean, John Maynard Keynes famously said that an economist must be four things. There are four crucial elements. One is mathematician. Then there's also historian, statesman, and philosopher. Notice how those last three are really part of the humanities. So I think a robust economics education is also a good humanistic education.
Well, you are listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Mina Kim. And I think we've got time for a couple more phone calls. Why don't we go to David in San Francisco? Hi, David.
Hi, well, thanks for taking my call and so many interesting talks. Really looking forward to reading your book. You know, I wanted to just take a hear your opinion on something I think is important. In general, the capitalist debate that is at risk of being oversimplified is being kind of blamed for a lot of issues, or at least by our callers kind of thought as maybe a spot that's going to inevitably lead to these issues and kind of fighting against regulation. I want to point to maybe the healthcare system as a counterexample and hear your thoughts on that. In particular, our healthcare system, which is our most regulated industry, and now is in an unprecedented time where firms run by private equity are buying out hospitals as well as medical groups and forming essentially monopolies or duopolies in regions and driving up the cost of care. But the issue isn't necessarily that they're driving the cost of care up, but it's that investment that's being made and the money that's being made from the care, instead of going back into the system, in other cases would be back into the workers or back into the care for the patients themselves, it's being siphoned off by these firms that are then taking that money and then paying off their own shareholders, which a lot of times are large private equity groups and whoever's investing in them. And I was just wondering your thought on that and how we can kind of prevent that. I guess the only issue is there some distraction for what I think is that main issue? Again, resources being siphoned off of critical industries, Boeing is another example of this, and then placed back into shareholders rather than reinvesting in the systems themselves. Is that something that, again, more important than some of these smaller issues of capitalism that we're going to see as we kind of go through this trial and error that is inherent in capitalism? So I'll take the answer off the air, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much. That's a great question. I mean, I absolutely share the sense that the dominance of private equity across many different industries has not been healthy for, I mean, quite literally, it has not been healthy for patients, but it has not really been healthy for small businesses. I mean, even if all you care about is kind of one of the mainstream Republican talking points of like the small business owner in America, well, that figure is dramatically threatened by private equity. And this is true from like veterinary practices to like you mentioned, hospitals, a lot of manufacturing, real estate is another area. I mean, the housing crisis has certainly not been helped by treating homes as just another asset class for investors to diversify into. I mean, so yes, there's a lot to be critical of with private equity. I wasn't quite sure if the implication of the question was that healthcare is overregulated. I mean, I think I don't go too far into healthcare in the book, but one of the things that I do talk a lot about is whether private equity can actually be a tool for expanding worker ownership. So there are a few models for private equity that I have a bit more sympathy for. One of them basically involves buying businesses, converting them into shared ownership models, and then going away. So I think there's some role for private equity, but that's not currently the dominant way the industry operates.
Great question. Thank you so much, David. Let's go next to Phil in San Francisco. Hi, Phil.
Oh, hi. Appreciate your show. My concern, it should be all our concerns, is the recent enormous advancements in artificial intelligence and robotics. It's going to take the majority of the jobs out there much faster than we can think. Microsoft is buying OpenAI a $100 billion.
Well, Phil, let's let Nick get to it because we have just a couple minutes left. So Nick, the coming AI-driven job apocalypse, does that just make everything we're talking about here moot?
No, not at all. I mean, I think reasonable people can disagree about the scale and severity of those disruptions. The broader point, though, is one that I really try to emphasize in the job guarantee chapter, which is that it's a political decision what we do with a latent workforce. I mean, there's all sorts of work that needs to be done. I'm thinking especially of care work and green transition work. I think we're still a long way away from wanting our older parents or our young children to be cared for by machines. There's no shortage of work, and it's a political decision whether we'd like to sort of guarantee a job to people who are interested in working and contributing in some way.
You know, as the process of writing this book, Nick, has it made you more hopeful about the near future or less hopeful?
I think more hopeful, and I guess one possibility is that's just availability bias, because I've spent a few years with these case studies and examples was traveling around and talking to a lot of people doing interesting, compelling things. I'm clear-eyed about the strength of the headwinds, so you know I wouldn't want to overstate the optimism, but the goal in the book was to show that at least at the level of sort of proof of concept, there are a broad range of viable, attractive, alternative ways to organize our economies.
Last question. What do you think your next book is going to be about?
That's a wonderful question. You know, I'm interested in continuing to explore how philosophy, literature, and the humanities can reshape our thinking about the economy. You know, if we take seriously Keynes's insight that economics is a branch of political philosophy, well, then suddenly a lot of other resources become available for rethinking and re-understanding economics.
Beautifully put. Well, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Nick Romeo, writer for The New Yorker, lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and author of a new book called The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy, which, if you haven't picked it up yet, dear listener, offers a short list of intriguing and provocative ways that people in a number of developed economies around the world are challenging the givens of red in tooth and claw capitalism. Keep the conversation going online. We are everywhere on Twitter, or X as you like to call it, Instagram, Facebook, Discord. You can find us at KQED Forum, where you can continue this conversation or suggest new conversations that you feel we should be having here at Forum on KQED. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Mina Kim. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.